places later, but becoming brighter. Sunny spells and scattered showers for Wales and Scotland. Those showers will become isolated later in the afternoon. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Glenn Moore.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Paul in Islington. Hello, Paul.
Hello there, sir.
Hi.
I'd just like to ask you where on God's earth you get this sum of money for people going on sick notes. Most of us don't even get sick pay. I'm a paramedic. I don't even get sick pay if I get a disease from the hospital.
And just to remind my listeners, because many people tune in at this hour, Paul, don't go. Just to give them background, this is a blitz by the government to crack down on what is believed to be more than a million taking sick leave for over a month each year, which, they say, costs the economy north of £9 billion. That's to give the listeners a recap. On you go, Paul, for your question.
Yes, like I say, I'm a paramedic. I don't even get sick pay at all.
Right.
So when I go and get a sick note, I have to pay for it. So where, in God's name, I'm reporting it to the police to move you.
I think something's going on. You're a paramedic. Stay on the line. I sense you need something to deal with. That's certainly here. This is the front page of one of the newspapers today, Deputy Prime Minister.
So what this is about, Paul. I don't know whether he can listen or he's not.
Paul, will you come back to us or are you working?
Sorry.
That's all right, mate. No, you've got a job to do. Right. Yeah. The Deputy Prime Minister's talking to you now. Go ahead.
So, Paul, what this is about is basically asking GPs, and it's very much in their hands to to decide this, that where they feel they have someone who has been off sick, off work for a month, but the GP thinks that they could still work, that they're giving the GPs the option, encouraging them to refer those individuals. So clearly not someone who's, undergoing treatment is very sick, but encouraging that person into a process where they're helped into work. And I think that is a sensible way of doing this. This is not... Firstly, this is not for frog marching people into the job centre where they where they're simply not in a position to do that. It's people who've taken time off work because they've been calling off sick, but where the GP thinks that they could nonetheless work. And I think that is a sensible thing to do because you don't want people off work for much longer than is really, necessary or frankly good for them. So that's what this is about. And I think, I think most people would kind of think that's kind of common sense. If the GP thinks that they could get back to work, you should be encouraging them to do so.
Response from you, Paul?
I don't really understand the sum of money. That's the thing. If no one's getting sick pay and you have for the certificate yourselves, where is the loss there apart from to the person that's sick?
I think that's what's really excellent. It may be a little unfair because I think, although he's responsible for many things, I don't think he actually comes up with these equations. But it is interesting how they reached this sum, Deputy Prime Minister, £9 billion. I think that's what's causing consternation here.
Well, of course it costs the economy and employers a lot of money if people are just off sick and you can't replace that person and they're off sick for a long period of time, longer than they need to be. I mean, I think, Paul, we might be slightly talking slight cross purposes about how much sick pay do you get, and that frankly depends on where you're working, of course. But I think the figure that you might be referring to, Paul, is the fact that clearly having a lot of people not at their desk, not at work when they could be. I happen to have a sort of old-fashioned view that on the whole, work is kind of good for people.
You, yep.
If you can be nudged back into work, then that is a good thing. But it's also good for the economy, because if people are off sick instead, of course that costs the economy money.
Paul, good luck with what you're doing. It's a crucial job out there on the front line. Thanks
indeed
for all your
is.
Activities. Mr. Clegg, where do we go next?
Abdul in Hammersmith. Hello, Abdul.
Hello, good morning. I've got a question regarding the rise of Islamophobia, and I don't hear many politicians talking about this, that the Muslim community in the UK is so vulnerable. We feel targeted because of what's going on overseas. And we feel that we're living under scrutiny 24/7. I mean, I have my wife that can't even go down to the shops without people saying things at her, swearing at her. And what are you going to do regarding keeping the Muslim community safe in the UK?
So what was the last bit, Abdul?
What are you going to do about keeping Muslim community safe in the UK?
So Abdul, I think the great tragedy is you are quite rightly saying that many law-abiding Muslim Britons are feeling that they are somehow being regarded with suspicion because of the horrific violence committed in the name of Islam, completely, you know, completely sort of by this perverted ideology, which is actually appropriating and misappropriating Islam elsewhere in the world. And at the same time, as we also know, you have parents in our Jewish communities who are feeling quite unsure about what's going to happen to their kids when they drop them off at school. Are they being properly protected? This is the great tragedy, is that all different communities are feeling increasingly insecure. And the role of the government, of course, is to make sure that all communities are as properly protected as possible. So, for instance, I said this week that I thought certainly any government of which the Liberal Democrats are a part in the future, and I very much hope, frankly, any government of any political persuasion will continue the funding that is provided via the something called the Community Security Trust to Jewish faith schools to make sure they're properly protected. But also, I said at the same time, and of course we should look at extending the same kind of protection to Muslim faith schools where there are security issues around that as well. So of course we have a duty, Abdul, as you said, as a government, to make sure that all communities, regardless of their background, their ethnicity, their religion, feel safe in modern Britain. At the same time, though, of course, we all need to unite together, don't we, Abdul? I'm sure you agree on this. And this was the subject of this conference where President Obama spoke overnight in Washington, and say unambiguously that that there is nothing Islamic about so-called Islamic State. It is, in fact, a medieval perversion of a faith which is held dear by many, many millions of law-abiding Muslims around the country, around the world.
Abdul?
Which is true, but do you not think the right-wing media is making it worse in trying to fight this ideology that this is not what Islam is about, and they're still portraying Islam in such a negative light? I mean, what can be done regarding the media's stance on Islamophobia? Because we do feel the media is very Islamophobic.
Well, look, I mean, of course you need to keep the perverted terrorist medieval ideology of ISIL completely separate from Islam. It has nothing to do with...
Worried about the media, portrayal. Want the government necessarily controlling
I'm not going to start telling the media what to write. Of course not. That's not what you want in a free society, Abdul. But I tell you what I do strongly feel, and I suspect you will believe this as well, is that actually one of the people who speak most powerfully about what Islam really is, rather than the way it's been perverted and misappropriated by terrorists, are moderate, law-abiding Muslim Britons. And you know, the more that you and others, Abdul, can say, you know, this is nothing to do with my faith. It's in fact an outrage to you know, Muslim Britons that Islam is being invoked in that way by ISIL and others. I think that has a very powerful effect as well.
All right, Abdul, thank you. We started the show this morning, Deputy Prime Minister, looking at your manifesto idea regarding childcare and the provision of free childcare for all children of working parents aged between 9 months and 2 years, which would be savings of around £2,670, plus free childcare for all two-year-olds, saving the family £2,540. Your Lib Dem colleague Jo Swinson was on the line. She just reminded everybody, Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Women and Equalities, and I pushed on how this would be paid, which we're going to try and bring to you now. Yes, here we are. This is Joseph. Yeah. The reality is you're taking away from, say, a married couple with one hand and giving it back with the other.
But we also might be giving it to help couples who don't happen to be married but also are facing real significant challenges.
But then if I'm married without children, all I'm doing is giving.
Yes, you're... Right. So, I mean, at the moment, you have a situation where, you know, if you're married and you have this tax break and then you end up, your partner dies, then you suddenly don't have that tax break anymore.
It's not a fair
and sensible policy, and the money would be much better spent supporting the next generation and helping parents with childcare costs.
Sure. Yeah, I still don't know why she was laughing. So I'm married and I don't have children, and then I get my tax break taken away.
So let's dwell a little bit on this great tax break. Of course, it is not actually given to all married couples at all under the Conservative scheme. So if you're two teachers, you don't get it. If you're someone who believes passionately in marriage...
This
but you're
because of financial reasons.
But it's true. Actually, you know, so lots and lots of married people who think they're going to get this great tax break aren't going to get it. That's the first point. Right. Second point...
When does it kick in? How much salary?
I think it's April of this year. Second,
how much? How much is it that there comes in? How much do you have to earn that you actually get it?
I think it's 10... I think one of the married couple... One of the partners needs to earn 10,000 or less, I think. I need to check. So lots and lots of married couples listening to this who think they're going to be suddenly, you know, in financial, you know, financial benefit, and not even get this great, much touted conservative, what I call unmarried tax penalty. Secondly, if you, let's say if you passionately believe in marriage, but you're a woman,
as you do.
Well, as I do, as I do. But I don't know, your husband's run off with his secretary in a sort of midlife fit of midlife crisis or whatever. You get what? You suddenly get the tax break. If you did receive it, you're going to get it taken away from you. If you're a widow, your husband's died, you don't get it. Mm. It's an extremely it's £800 million of taxpayers' money being spent on a small number of people who jump through particular hoops set by the Conservative Party. We think it's better to scrap that, use it obviously to balance the books, which we've got to do over the next couple of years, and then once we balance the books in 2017-18, spend about £800 million to make sure that all two-year-old toddlers from whatever family, whatever we know whether they are unmarried.
Wayne Rooney's children again.
Well, let's come back to when really.
But why first, is it? I'm paying for his children's school meals, and now I'm paying for his next children's nursery.
Yes, but you're also paying
the
man's to
richer than Croesus.
But you're, poor Wayne Rooney. That's all I say. Poor Wayne Rooney, lambasted by
good luck to the man.
Listen, you've been paying for Wayne Rooney to have the right to go to his local NHS. And get treated on the NHS, and as you have every single person who's extremely wealthy in this country. There are certain things that we believe as a country should be universally provided for. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that giving all families with 2 and 3 and 4 year olds the ability to have free from the state 15 hours preschool support, it has a fantastic effect. Not only on their public, on their household finances for those who are on lower incomes, not the Wayne Rooney's. It also has a dramatic effect on the ability of children subsequently to do well in school. So I think it is money well spent, and certainly better spent than this higgledy-piggledy partial sort of jump through lots of hoops tax break for some married couples but not for others.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Jihadists have released a video showing the murder of 21 Egyptians who they captured in Libya around Christmas time. The Egyptians are dressed in orange jumpsuits and are beheaded after being forced down on the ground. The video appeared on the Twitter feed of a website that supports the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL. A caption on the video, which runs for 5 minutes, says, "The people of the cross, followers of the hostile Egyptian church. The 21 men, all migrant workers hailing from impoverished areas of central Egypt, were kidnapped between late December and early January. 14 came from the same village." ISIL claims to have established affiliate groups in 3 different areas of Libya, a common destination for Egyptian Christians, and a witness talks of the abductions of several of the men and talks of how black-clad jihadists entered their living quarters in the middle of the night carrying a list of named Christians. It's not easy being a Christian at the moment, is it? Let's speak with Mina Thabet, a researcher at the Egyptian Commission for Rights and Freedoms based in Cairo. What does this say about the safety of Christians in this area? Good morning.
Good morning, sir. First of all, we would like to send our deep sympathy with the victims' family. And about the safety of the Coptic Christians on Libyan lands, it's not negotiable now. We can see that 21 yesterday had been slaughtered to death. So it's very dangerous for Christians to be there, and it was very dangerous from 2 years ago. It's from 2012. Actually, we have been tracked. We have been monitoring the situations, and it was documented that a pattern of violation against Christians had been documented. The targeting Christians because of their belief. Before yesterday, we have more than 20 Christians have been slaughtered to death, killed, shot in the head for the last 3 years. Yesterday, it became now more than 40 or 42 dead Christians. The extremist groups in Libya had targeted the Coptic church in Benghazi, had targeted the Coptic church in Misrata. So it's very obvious now that Libya became a case just like Syria and Iraq.
So what needs to be done, lastly, Mr. Thabet?
What needs to be done that First of all, we have to secure, because we have another 8 hostages. Until now, we don't know where are they or if they are with Daesh or not. But now, first thing we have to do is to secure their way back home, to secure the people trapped in Libya, because we have Christians trapped in Libya, we have Egyptians trapped in Libya until now. They can't came out because the road is not clear. And second, for the old world, you have to know that terrorism is not away from you. It's in your own backyard, and it's in England, it's in Europe, it's in everywhere. These are not NGOs or are not movements or not troops. They are thoughts, and these thoughts are is expanding every year. We have to stop these thoughts. We have to stop these people, and we have to help the Middle East. Middle East have to have more concern by the whole world.
Mina Thabet, thank you. A researcher at the Egyptian Commission for Rights and Freedoms. You're based in Cairo. It's 11 minutes after 8. Let's speak with Oliver Miles, a former British diplomat to Libya and former visiting professor to the American University of Cairo, who joins me now. What is the current state, the current level of unrest within Libya?
It's not a failed state, but it's fairly bad. There's been sporadic fighting in different parts of the country. Most of the time, Tripoli itself has been calm. People that live there relatively normally. The black spot is Derna, which is one particular town in the eastern part of Libya, which has a very bad reputation for Islamic extremism, and that was, I think, the target of the Egyptian air raids this morning, which were a reaction to this awful murder.
When we look back at the times of Gaddafi, I can't even believe I'm going to say this. Presumably it was more secure. How was it then in that it's different now? In what way has it changed?
Well, in every possible way. I mean, the situation under Gaddafi was that you had one-man rule. Provided you didn't antagonise Gaddafi, you were pretty safe. If you did antagonise him, you got hanged.
So I asked my other contributor what needs to be done. He's speaking from the work and the work that he's done. From your knowledge of the area and having served in the area, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, I think the first thing, before you can consider that, you have to think about what these terrorists or extremists or whatever we like to call them are trying to achieve themselves. Obviously, the first objective of this awful crime was to frighten the enemies of the Islamic State. The second was, I think, to provoke a reaction which will can be represented as imperialism, aggression, crusade, or whatever you like to call it, so as to recruit more fighters. The whole presentation, I haven't actually watched the video myself, and I have no intention of doing so, but it was very, very professionally done. It's presented very carefully, and that is the purpose of it. So we need to think, how should we react? And I think the answer is we should react very carefully without meeting their expectation of turning this into some kind of imperialist or crusading activity. In other words, we've got to help the people of the area to deal with it. It's encouraging that the very first thing that happened after the murder was the Egyptian airstrike on Derna, because that coming from Egypt is very, very different from an airstrike coming from America or from us or from anyone outside the region.
Can you ever see an alliance of countries in the region with US, possibly UK, or other Western support being put together and holding together?
Yes, certainly I can. Why not? I mean, that's what's happened several times. It happened, for example, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait 25 years ago. There was a Western alliance which had not all, but most, nearly all, of the Arab states actively participating in putting right or wrong. That could be done again. We've made it much more difficult for ourselves by, to my mind, hopelessly ill-judged wars. Most significantly, of course, our invasion of Iraq which has made it much more difficult for us to work with people in the region. But that's what we've got to try to do.
Lastly, who brokers that?
The war in Iraq?
No, sorry, the alliance.
The original alliance?
A new one. Would it fall to the US? Who do you think would have enough respect? Who would all the necessary parties listen to?
That's a very good question. I think that we've lost the respect of the... We, the West, have lost the respect of the people in the region, and it's very difficult to see how it could be led from here. Being an old-fashioned diplomat myself, I have a lot of faith in the United Nations, and we have a very good attempt by the United Nations currently, which is not getting much publicity, but perhaps they like it that way, to achieve a political settlement in Libya. The UN representative there has been successful in bringing together the factions in Libya, many of the factions, not all of them, many of the factions in Libya, over the last 2 weeks. The things seem to be snowballing. Let's hope that this ghastly event will stimulate more Libyans to cooperate with that initiative.
As always, thanks so much for your input. Oliver Miles, you were former British diplomat to Libya, also former visiting professor to American University in Cairo. Let's speak with Ihab, who is in the south of France. Ihab, you're on the radio. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Nice to talk to you, Nick. Okay, I just wanted to give my two cents as a Coptic Christian, someone from the Middle East.
Yep.
And that is, I felt the gentleman from Egypt poorly answered your question as what needs to be done. And
yep.
I think what needs to be done, Nick, is really looking at the school curriculum in Egypt, in countries like Egypt, which indeed teaches hatred to non-Muslims. And there was a debate on Al Jazeera a few years ago where freethinker Sayyid Al-Kimni actually presented the page numbers where kids are being taught to hate. Like, here, you want to love God, hate. Hate non-Muslims. And his ideas on how to hate. And this is a Wahhabi idealism. I mean, mm-hmm. a Wahhabi sort of style of teaching Islam. I don't know where the curriculum has been taught, but I think Pakistan is a good example where it may have been translated and being used as part of a teaching manual. You've seen this in the UK, and I think you're familiar with the Newsnight episode where Paxman interviews the head of Al Fahd Academy and says, "Well, what is Montez doing in your school books?
Yes.
Why are you teaching hatred in your school book?" And unfortunately, I think Jeremy did a very bad job because he just brushed it off. He asked the lady, "Well, explain the context of these things," and she didn't explain, and he just let it drop, thinking, "Well, it's just
what
one."
Where should he have gone with that interview then?
Well, ask her. Don't leave. Just say, "Well, explain to me the context of why you're calling Christians monkeys and Jews pigs. Why are you doing that for? Why are you teaching that to your kids for? Surely that's teaching them hatred. Why?" And she just brushed up saying, "Oh, it's you just misunderstood the context." Don't let it drop. That's the whole point, is the context.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. Ken Livingstone and David Mellor. Saturday mornings from 10.
The increasing number of American politicians saying that Putin is a real threat to Western Europe.
I mean, the thing about Putin is he a serious loony tune who would actually go to war? Or is he someone who's actually basically a decent fellow, kind to animals, helps old ladies across the roads, and would just back off when it all gets tricky?
Ken Livingstone and David Mellor. Saturday mornings from 10. Only on LBC. On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 5:30, 75 firefighters and 15 fire engines are tackling a large fire in southeast London.
Cameron incensed as bishops stir welfare row. Church leaders launch attack on political culture. And in the view of that newspaper, The Times, the relations between the Church of England and Westminster plumbed to a new low after bishops launched what the paper calls a withering assault on Britain's political culture. It's a letter endorsed by the Archbishop of Canterbury and the entire membership of the House of Bishops, and it claims democracy is failing, and it talks of widespread disengagement among the public. It warns that Christians need to engage in politics to counter the cynicism and sex appeal of people such as Russell Brand, the comic, well, he's supposedly a comic, who recently told people not to bother voting in the next general election. It's within a pastoral letter styled as a guide to the election in May, and it's reported that it has worsened conditions between David Cameron, as I say, and the Church of England. The letter attacks all parties for their failure to produce an attractive vision, but it criticises in particular the Conservatives with its commentary on welfare. It also contains support for the structures of Europe and questions the need for a nuclear deterrent. Earlier in the show, I spoke with Labour leader Harriet Harman. She was talking about that ghastly pink bus tour that hits Croydon, if you're interested. But I asked her to respond on some of the themes in this letter from the Church.
Well, I think the Church and any religious organisation is absolutely entitled to have their say. And I remember 30 years ago, the Faith in the City report that the churches all, the Church of England got together and did. And I think if they, you know, they're thinkers, they're philosophers, they're theologists, they've got a right to have their say. I mean, actually, government decisions are made by people who are elected, and that's what will happen. But I think that people putting their views forward, more power to their elbow.
Stephen Lowe is a retired bishop with the Church of England and joins me now. This is meant to be a pastoral letter, I understand, sir, but clearly it's a political one, isn't it?
Well, to separate pastoral and political is a bit of a false dichotomy there. Nick, I'm quite convinced that the Church, because of the nature of the Christian gospel, the Christian message, should actually be speaking out at times of great democratic decision for the nation about issues that really matter. The issues that really matter are to do with the ordinary lives of the men and women who are electing the politicians. And this is a pastoral letter to the parishes, to the people in the church, and anybody else who wants to take notice of it, that things are not right in our political system. The different parties, it say, as you said, have failed to offer attractive visions of the kind of society and culture they people wish to see, or distinctive goals they might pursue. And there's a lack of vision from all our politicians, the pastoral letter says, and what this pastoral letter is trying to do is to raise some of the big questions and maybe even offering some answers at times in terms of principles to, so that the politicians can respond and the questions can be asked by ordinary people in part of the democratic process in the general election.
But it is taking a political stance when it says, and I'm quoting, "It has been widely observed that the greatest burdens of austerity have not been borne by those with the broader shoulders." That's virtually the Labour Party mantra.
No, it isn't. It's actually, it isn't. It may be the Labour Party mantra. It's actually the Labour Party believe that, but it's actually, from our point of view, as the Church is saying, that is the case in our society, and from a Christian perspective.
Well, respectfully, sir.
From a Christian perspective,
I have to just point out the higher proportion of wage earners have never paid more tax. Now, there is an argument that they should, but they have never paid more. So, for the Church to just blithely say, oh, well, that's a fact, it's actually not quite a fact, because the rich have never paid more.
Well,
in in full proportion.
Never been richer, Nick, and you know that as well as I
do. But that's not a role for the Church.
The wealth of the smallest part of the population, the 1%, has grown in an enormous way, while the majority of people in this country have actually stayed either on their same wages or, in fact, have seen the value of their wages decline. So it is the poorer people, particularly poorer people in work, who have borne the principal burden of the austerity of the last 4 or 5 years.
Respectfully, Your Grace, I may as well be speaking to a Labour politician now.
Not at all. I'm raising issues which come directly from my own beliefs as a Christian and as Christian bishop, and this is what the House of Bishops pastoral letter has been trying to do.
From austerity then to Europe, again I quote, "There is an enduring argument for continuing to build structures of trust and cooperation between the nations of Europe." Now, you may, indeed, the Church may be right, but why is the Church taking a position on Europe?
Well, why shouldn't we? We are...
Because you're there to save my soul, not to decide, not to tell me whether I'm going to be ruled by Brussels.
Are you actually saying, Nick, that the Christian churches are only concerned with individual morality and have no vision for the sort of society and world in which we want to live?
But, Your Grace, where were you when the debate first started? Where was the Church when we actually had a vote, however many years ago? Where was the Church when the immigration problem started? Why now? Why just 70-something days out of a general election? Where were you when we all needed guidance?
What do you mean, where were we? We all needed guidance. The church is...
When we had a vote, I wasn't old enough to vote, but my understanding is, and you may be older than me, I have no idea, sir, but there was a vote at some point to come out of Europe. I was a child, I don't remember. Where was the church guidance then? When immigration started to get ugly, where was the church guidance then?
The church guidance was there, Nick. You've forgotten about it. The church issued a paper on Christians in Europe. It offered guidance on those issues. And as far as I'm concerned, the church is simply raising questions about how we want to live with our neighbours, our fellow nations in Europe, what sort of relationship we want with them, and is it something that we should actually try and pursue, not a policy of separation and division from them, but actually maybe growing closer to them? That is a proper question to be asking in a general election preceding, possibly, a referendum on whether we stay or not in the European Union.
And it's also necessary for us to know how the Church of England feels about about anti-nuclear deterrence.
Of course, and we've issued, as you may remember, we've issued... major papers on the whole issue of nuclear deterrence over the last 50 years. It's been a constant source of... there was a book called The Church and the Bomb, which we talked about the whole issue of nuclear deterrence, and I think it's raising very properly now the question whether or not the nuclear deterrent, which has been something which the three major parties all support, as far as I understand it, or certainly the Conservatives and the Labour Party are concerned... the church is raising the question, can we afford to have nuclear deterrence in a world where the politics of defence have changed enormously in the last 20 years? And is it still a relevant weapon?
But lastly,
that is a question that should be asked and answered by politicians within
your Grace,
the debate around a general election.
The power of your church, the power of your profession was that you rose above all things. You rose above politics, you rose above... You were there on a different plane. Now, respectfully, you're telling me how I should think about Europe, nuclear deterrence, austerity measures. You've come down to their level. You've lost all majesty.
That's absolute nonsense, Nick. We actually, as a church, I hope week by week, in the worship of God, in the churches, raise people's souls in a magnificent way, in all sorts of ways. But to actually... as part of our belief in the Christian gospel and the teaching of Jesus, we actually need to be making a contribution to debate about what sort of society and world we want to live in.
I'm very grateful for your time and thank you for your robust argument. Good luck to you and all your studies and prayers. Stephen Lowe, retired bishop with the Church of England, listening. Andrew Pearce, a journalist, author, broadcaster, columnist, says here, no, he's with the Daily Mail. Who wrote that? He's an LBC presenter. You're with the Daily Mail, aren't you, Andrew?
I certainly am. I'm not really an author, although I did work on a book.
I know. They've moved your title. I won't tell you what newspaper they put you on. You're an executive editor at the Daily Mail and, of course, one of my colleagues on LBC as well. Now, there's a big piece, actually, in the Daily Mail today. What do you take from what you're hearing from this church letter?
I'm astonished, actually, Nick. It's a blatantly party political intervention. In a week in which you'd have thought the church had more to say over the senseless massacre of 21 Coptic Christians in Libya just the other day, when Christians are being murdered and persecuted in parts of the Middle East by the Islamic extremists. And if you go through the document, they even say here, I just found it, they come close to just glossing over the fact that unemployment has been falling dramatically when they say, it's good that unemployment has not risen as high as was predicted. They just can't bring it on to themselves to say, actually, the economy is going far quicker than any economy in Western Europe. I'm not being party free here. That is a fact, that unemployment has fallen below 2 million, when Labour, of course, and some of these left-wing bishops told us it was going to soar above 3.5 million. It is completely dishonest, Nick. And the point about trying, I'm glad you raised that with the bishop, because it is entirely possible to argue from a Christian point of view that retaining a nuclear deterrent keeps the peace and therefore is a more Christian act by a government rather than surrendering a nuclear deterrent and relying on other countries to do our defence for us. What they should also be concentrating on is their falling congregation numbers, which are now, I think, 850,000. When I started out in journalism in 1979, Nick, 5 million people were going to church every Sunday in the Anglican Church. It is a cataclysmic decline, and it's because bishops like the one you were talking to have got completely the wrong sense of priorities. They're not doing their flock any good at all. They should be concentrating on why the pews are emptying at an alarming rate.
Views like that available every Saturday here on LBC from Andrew Pearce. He's an executive editor at the Daily Mail. He's one of my LBC colleagues every Saturday morning with Breakfast. Andrew, good to talk to you. Thank you. This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. Anyone ill for more than 4 weeks will face a fit-for-work test under a government clampdown on the sick note culture that costs the economy billions each year. All GPs will be Gosh, they never stop issuing directives and diktats to GPs, do they? Imagine being a doctor. What was it earlier? I can't remember what it was. You just get in, open the paper or open your emails. Oh, God, the government's telling me to do something else now. I've only got to see 45 patients who are all going to cough all over me. Now I've got to tell you this. All GPs will be expected to refer patients to a company that will assess their ability to work and draw up a plan for their return. The aim is to stop people languishing, nice word, on benefits for long-term sickness. More than 1 million people take sick leave for over a month each year. More than 1 million of you take sick leave for over a month each year. Goodness me. There's also a cost. I don't know how they work it out. But they've worked out the cost to the economy. I'll share that with you in just a second. I'll also share with you the cost of this idea. But will it work? Have you ever been off work for 4 weeks? I'm so fortunate. Is there any wood in this studio? Probably not. Is this? I found a bit. I'm so fortunate I've never had that problem. I think it would send me... I would be... Well, close enough as it is, it wouldn't be a long journey. But it would send me stark raving bonkers if I couldn't... I cannot imagine it. But of those people who do it, how many are, am I allowed to use the expression, swinging the lead? I don't quite know where that expression comes from. I hope it's nothing offensive. But how many are just taking the mick, would you say? Well, let's talk to a doctor. Dr. Barbara Murray is a GP. She's based in Stockport, joins me now. Doctor, every day, another missive. Why did you ever come into medicine? Good morning.
Hello, good morning. Well, I'm asking myself that question, quite frankly, and so are all my colleagues. There's a distinct lack of trust for GPs at the moment, the ability to decide when a patient is ill and capable of working and when they're actually, as you said, swinging the lead. It's a dilemma we face every day. But to be perfectly frank, I don't believe there is a sick note culture, and certainly not amongst the patients I see every day, who I sometimes have to persuade to stay off sick because they don't get paid when they're off sick. Mm. And they beg me not to put them off sick. I think it's appalling that these patients are going to be referred to an occupational health company, and they will speak to a person over the phone who won't be a doctor. There'll be a trained nurse or an occupational therapist who, it would seem, is better qualified than a doctor to decide over the telephone whether somebody is fit to work or not. The examples I can think of from only yesterday would be a person who has fractured their ankle in several places and has had major surgery and has a stand-up job. How on earth they would be expected to go back to work when it takes 6 weeks for the average fracture to heal, I don't know. And so that person is obviously fit for work, I don't think. People who have... The majority of people who are off work for more than 4 weeks will be people with mental health problems. Half the people I know would certainly not be able to hold down a conversation, let alone hold down a job, if they're off work for... If we have decided that they are not fit for work for 4 weeks, they are not fit for work for 4 weeks. And I understand that the plan will be for them to be referred for counselling or cognitive behavioural therapy. Well, good luck with that one. Because there's at least a 3-month waiting list in my area for any of those services. How on earth do they think this is going to work?
But if there are more than 1 million taking sick leave for over a month in each year, some of those are going to be chancing their arm, aren't they?
Some of them, maybe. But why would... I would ask myself, why would they want to do that? It's because there are no other...
Because it's easier to stay at home, isn't it? It's easier to stay at home, possibly, than get up and do a job they hate.
Well, I understand you're playing devil's advocate.
Well, honestly, I'm not. No, I very rarely say things
like that. It certainly is not easier for them to stay at home. The benefits they get are very, very minimal. The people I see are desperate. You know, and there are homeless people who would love to have the opportunity to work. These are not people who there may be the odd person who thinks, well, I'll pretend I've got a bad back, but they can't keep that up. And they already get referred. They already get seen. We get notes through all the time from the healthcare companies to say, we have seen your patient, we have decided that they are fit for work, we have put them on a return to work programme, whatever that is. They have to go to a maths class or something, or a computer course to enable them to have the skills to go back to work. These things already exist. I don't understand where this initiative has come from.
All right. Well, it may be the cash prerogative, and I'm going to share with the listeners just how much money it is claimed this costs us, but strong views, and I'm grateful. Dr. Barbara Murray is a GP based in Stockport. Listening, James Bartholomew, who's former journalist with the FT, Financial Times, written The Welfare of Nations, which is out next month. We may well indeed speak to him close to publication date, and he joins me now. Strong views from the medical profession there. Do you think this is as big a problem as perhaps it's being portrayed?
Well, I mean, I think the figure you've mentioned yourself makes it very clear that it's a problem. Mm. 1 million people taking sick leave for over a month every year. I mean, it is practically unbelievable. The thing you've got to bear in mind is that the rate at which people appear to be sick or indeed incapable of work for long periods of time varies enormously from over time and over countries. And it beggars belief, for example, that there should be 10 times as many people incapable of work in Sweden than there are in Japan. And it's similarly in Britain. We had a vast increase in numbers on incapacity benefit. It tripled over less than 18 years. And that was GPs signing people off as being ill and too ill to work. Mm. And it's just simply not true that the amount of incapacity grew in that time. It's just not just clearly rubbish. Mm. And what happens is, in the real world, is that somebody goes along to the GP, they have a problem, they probably genuinely at the beginning do have a problem. Or maybe they've been made unemployed. But they go and say, can you sign me off? And the GP, the easiest course of action for the GP is, well, either they say yes, sign a piece of paper, and off the person goes, or else they are going to have an argument. And if they do they really feel like an argument when they've got 30 ill people waiting outside? No, it's far simpler to just sign it off. And I'm afraid that the kind of action you need to try and persuade these people, yes, you must try and work if you can. You mustn't go off sick with mental problems if you can possibly avoid it, because actually mental problems are likely to get worse if you don't work and you're hanging around all day.
But you heard the reaction from a doctor on the front line briefly, Mr. Bartholomew. She wasn't for it at all.
No, but that's one doctor. And I've spoken to one or two GPs who have said, you know, it just takes a lot of courage to say no, and you know they feel they must do, because they feel it's outrageous that these people are ripping off either their employer or the taxpayer.
I will leave it there, James Bartholomew. Thank you. Former FT journalist, now written The Welfare of Nations, and that's out next month. The Welfare of Nations. Let's speak with Robert, who's in Epsom. Robert, what can you tell me about this? Do you agree with the idea? Good morning.
Quite frankly, Mr. Ferrari, I think it's disgusting. You're getting people on the sick for 10 years or more.
Yes,
yeah, me. All it needs to be 6 weeks, and that's it. And I go back on the dole.
Right.
Anyway, I found out my local job.
How long have you been on the dole?
Quite a number of years. And I've had frustration of trying to find a job and keep applying for work.
What's quite a number of years? What's that? 5, 6, 10?
No, more than that.
15?
Yeah, well, 12 to be precise. Well, 10 years at least, 10 years.
10 years on the dole. I hear what you're saying. I'm sorry you've been looking for work for so long. There's absolutely nothing out there. You can't get a job in a store or something like that?
Everything now is geared to going online. And I have to go to the local library to go on use the computers there, to go online and look for work or apply for jobs if they come through on my email box.
Mm, mm.
And it's just so demeaning. It really is. And I've got people around where I live here, and they're all on sickness benefit for a long, long time, and they're just layabouts.
How much money do you get a week on the dole?
It's the basic minimum, and it works out to £144 a fortnight.
£144 a fortnight, did you say?
Yeah, £144 a fortnight.
And you don't pay your rent out of that, do you?
A part of my rent has to be paid out of that, yes.
Part of your
rent? Sometimes you don't have to, but in this case, where I live, I have to pay part of my rent out of that, and the gas, electric, and a few other bits and pieces.
That's really tough. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. Ken Livingstone and David Mellor. Saturday mornings from 10.
The increasing number of American politicians saying that Putin is a real threat to Western Europe.
I mean, the thing about Putin is he a serious loony tune who would actually go to war? Or is he someone who's actually basically a decent fellow, kind to animals, helps old ladies across roads, and would just back off when it all gets tricky?
Ken Livingstone and David Mellor. Saturday mornings from 10, only on LBC. Leading Britain's conversation, Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
The proportion of men taking their own lives in the UK has reached its highest level for more than a decade. I've certainly lost a friend to suicide, and I know the impact that can have on families and anyone who knows the individual, really. It's such a shock and a jolt.
Sheila Fogarty, weekday afternoons from 1, only on LBC. Weekend mornings from 10 on LBC. Tomorrow morning, Beverly Turner.
There's been a sort of reduction, hasn't there, in the dignity and the respect that we afford old people. You know, you used to be able to turn to an old-timer, didn't you, to explain the world. Well, now we get on Google. If we have trouble working the computer, we ask a teenager. If we're not respecting our old people enough, how are we going to give them the right source of care that they need?
Beverly Turner, Sunday morning from 10 on LBC. Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Ferrari at breakfast, every weekday morning from 7, only on LBC. Leading Britain's conversation, Ken Livingstone and David Mellor, Saturday mornings from 10.
The increasing number of American politicians saying that Putin is a real threat to Western Europe.
I mean, the thing about Putin is he a serious loony tune who would actually go to war? Or is he someone who's actually basically a decent fellow, kind to animals, helps old ladies across roads, and would just back off when it all gets tricky?
Ken Livingstone and David Mellor. Saturday mornings from 10, only on LBC. On FM.
Scotland, those showers will become isolated later in the afternoon. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Glenn Moore.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Is it not true, Mr. Clegg, that this is implemented in Australia, the idea of free childcare, provision of childcare, and it's so expensive they had to do a U-turn?
It depends how you do it. So what we have done, I'm very much under sort of my impetus and this government, we have given for the first time all 3- and 4-year-olds across the country 15 hours of free preschool support. Again, because of the impetus from the Liberal Democrats, we're giving 2-year-olds from the lowest income families the 40%.
Which they did in Oz, and it was so expensive, they had to reverse it.
Well, to actually give it to all 2-year-olds would cost another £800 million. We spend already as a society £6 billion on early years support. Now, I think, and this is, I think, the point that Joe was making, even though, actually, if you really must know, scrapping the unmarried tax penalty is something we would put towards dealing with the deficit. What we would then do is, once the deficit's dealt with in 2017-18, unlike the Conservatives, who, let's remember, want to then indulge in a further £38 billion worth of unnecessary cuts to public services, because they want to see the amount of money in public services remorselessly go down, we would relink the amount of money going to public services, including childcare and preschool support, to the growth of the economy. And it would save families up and down the country thousands of pounds. Right. Can I just contrast this? Because since you contrasted it with the Conservative tax break, their plan of taking 12 billion quid out of welfare alone would cost about 8 million people on modest incomes about £1,500. Now, you know, what is remotely fair about allowing tax dodgers to not pay a single extra penny towards balancing the books and instead penalising the working age poor?
Did your mum stay at home with you?
Yes.
We didn't do you any harm. You seemed to do all right.
Everybody's free to take their own choices.
Yeah, you were able to hang your coat up on the peg when you first walked into primary school, I imagine.
Indeed, the misunderstanding. You are firmly grabbing the wrong end of the stick on this issue. Look, it is entirely, of course, free for mums and indeed dads to stay. It's not for me to say, as a politician, what people should do with their own families. It is, however, for me as a politician to try and make those choices easier and to make sure that we do our bit to make sure that when kids start at school, they start well.
I think we have a related question,
Jennifer in Stratford.
Hi, yes.
Hello, Jennifer.
I actually have two questions I really wanted to talk about. The first one being, for childcare providers, we pay full business rates, yet we are providing care for 3- and 4-year-olds and also 2-year-olds in the same way as schools. So why is there never any talk about actually making it more affordable for childcare providers by actually reducing our business rates to make us more in line with these schools?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my first question. Yep. The second question is, with the funding for 2-, 3- and 4-year-olds, that is paid directly to providers, so why do you not pay tax credits for the element that parents get directly to providers? For two main reasons. The first one being that you would cut out a lot of the fraud that still goes on, and the second reason one being that, of course, you would actually reduce the cost of administering the scheme because you would have one payment going to a provider and you could do some sort of return that providers actually complete, more than having thousands of funds going out to parents individually.
So, Jennifer, very quickly, I mean, look, I would dearly like to see the business rate burdens and indeed other burdens on childcare providers freed up. In fact, we have, as you probably know, we've tried to free up some of the red tape, for instance, about registering, about, you know, how you register as a childminder, for instance. We're allowing schools to cater for 2- and 3- and 4-year-olds in a way, in a sort of lighter touch way than has previously. That's been controversial, as you know, in your sector, but I think it's sensible. And look, business rates generally need to be looked at from top to toe. Business rates are penal for many, many small businesses up and down the country, not just in your line of work. And we're now conducting, we announced this last December, the Treasury's conducting a sort of top-to-toe review of business rates because in many ways they are anachronistic, out of step with the kind of costs of doing business. And let's see what that review yields. On the funding, as you know, the funding goes from government, from central government to local authorities. So, and then local authorities, in a sense, pass it on to you. And they're, to be candid, there is sometimes a bit of a problem because we actually, as a central government, give to the local authorities a per pupil rate, which is actually much higher than the average rate charged to parents. And that's why I'm very keen to say to local authorities, look, you've got this money, we're not ring-fencing it, but you really should pass it on pretty well in full. So that you're not left short when you're providing that those free hours to parents. But I think it's right as a matter of principle that, for instance, the new universal credit, which will come into effect, it is actually money which goes into people's bank accounts. That's the whole point of it, that people use it responsibly and that it's not like the old benefit system with lots and lots of different benefits with lots of different strings attached. It is a sort of lump of money that people then have to manage responsibly. And it will include, by the way, for those on low incomes through the universal credit, 85% coverage of their childcare costs, up from the 70% of the costs that are covered at the moment. I think that's the right way round, but I hear what you say, Jennifer.
Jennifer, quick response from you, if you would.
Well, a couple of things, because before it was 85%, and then it went down to 70%.
I think it was 80, but...
80, sorry, 80.
It was 80, so it's going up to 85 rather. Yes, you're right.
And it was reduced, and now you're increasing it. But the issue often parents have, especially when they're first starting at a childcare provider, is that their tax credits don't come through straight away.
Right.
So therefore, it's a catch-22 for parents who want to go back to work, who don't have the financial means to actually pay for their childcare, and it wouldn't be right to expect childcare providers to subsidise that scheme in order for parents to do that. But when you're talking about the rates that providers actually get from the local authority in relation to the grant, there is a lot of issues in relation to that, and a lot of organisations are saying, as well as childcare providers, that you are underfunding the system. And that is one of the major issues.
Yeah.
And in relation to business rates, I think that's something that you could do in relation to childcare, because a lot of the talk is about affordability of childcare, but very few people talk about the cost of running childcare.
Sure. No, I think you make a fair point about the effect of business rates. I don't actually agree with you something about the rates, but, and if you want, I will get your details and send you through the rates that central government uses, which is quite, well, in fact, much more generous than the rates that are on average sort of charged across the country. So what I'm sort of rather diplomatically trying to say is I think sometimes there's a bit of a problem that the money that we actually provide, which according to, kind of put it like that, the kind of market rates are pretty generous, are not being handed through. What you say about tax credits is very interesting. I'll have a look at that. You're basically saying there's a cash flow issue for someone who's first taking up childcare, the childcare entitlement. If they don't have the money in the bank through the tax credit system to do so, who kind of tides them over? And let me, if I may, Jennifer, have a look at that.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's do an email. Thanks, Jennifer. Good luck with what you're doing. Let me put an email question to you. This comes from Albert in Leicestershire. Ed Miliband's plans for a mansion tax on homes, Lord Kinnock says, will cost little more than a slap-up meal. Does the Deputy Prime Minister think Lord Kinnock is right?
I think the idea that the Labour Party have, I think they have, of a sort of, you know, a kind of flat fee or levy above a certain amount. I mean, that's something we sort of, as a party, advocated the part. I actually think it doesn't make sense because what most people think is fairer is to have a sort of, you basically extend council tax bans in effect. Just up the kind of property scale. That's what we think is a more sensible way of doing it. Everyone, I think, kind of gets that we've got a property tax system. Council tax comes in different bands. Mm. Why should those bands stop at a certain amount? And so what we're working on is an approach which basically extends those bands. Technically, it might be slightly different to how the council tax system is administered, but the principle is that one. And that, I think, is what most people, I think, accept as a fair way of making sure that very high-value properties pay their fair share. Not in a punitive way, but in a way that means that they are basically treated the same as someone who's living in a more modest property.
All right, we move on to other calls.
Sam in Bexley. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Mr. Clegg.
Hello.
Good show.
You what?
Yeah, firstly, it's a privilege and honour for me to speak to you. Thank you for allowing me.
That's all right, Sam.
I've been listening to your show for a while. I've also been a member of the party. I became a member about 3 months ago.
Oh, Sam, member, let me embrace you over the airwaves.
Yeah, I bet there was a hell of a queue that you had to wait there to get into
Nick
the Ferrari's party.
Nick looking shocked for some reason. Sam, it does happen, Mr. Ferrari.
Sam, what is your question of the party leader?
Right. I would like to ask you, if you were to win the next general election...
Ah, yes.
Will you go back to your education policy 5 years ago to grant free tuition fees?
Good question.
Because, you've been blaming the coalition for not sticking to that promise.
Yep.
I have two students at uni, mm-hmm. and the third one on the way. So will you go back to the promise?
So Sam, I think once bitten, twice shy. I'm not going to make commitments in this area, and indeed any others, which I don't think we can deliver. Look, as you know, the arrangements which are now in place, which your kids are going through, it's, well, in a nutshell, it was the fairest deal I could get. It's quite simply that. It was the fairest deal I could get. And thankfully, as you know, Sam, it's proving to be much fairer than all the people predicted at the time. Partly because, as you know from your own children, in the system that was introduced by Labour, I mean, they airbrushed this out of history now, of course, but Labour introduced fees and then increased them, thousands of youngsters had to pay up front. As students, they had to pay the thousands of pounds of fees. We've taken that away. You don't need to pay anything up front. And basically what we've introduced, it would have saved me a lot of heartache if only we'd called it this. We've actually introduced, in effect, a very progressive graduate tax. You only pay back... Your kids, Sam, will only pay back many years after they leave university. And in fact, they'll only pay back if they can afford to do so. If they can't, if they're on low incomes or not working, they don't pay back a penny. And if they don't... They can't pay it back by the end of their working life. They don't have to. The outstanding amount will be paid for them. So I think it is more sensible, Sam, to have a look at the way the system is working now. And my own personal view, if you really must know, Sam, is that actually and I find this over and over again as I speak to students, is that the biggest preoccupation for students these days is not the repayment system that they have to go through many years after they've left university, because I think many of them have worked out that in many respects it's fairer and more affordable than the system it's replaced, but is the upfront grants they get to cover their maintenance costs, their living costs at university. And there, we've got a good story to tell, Sam. We've increased the amount of grants going to youngsters from the most disadvantaged families, but I personally think that's the area where any future government might want to do more.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
It's one thing for the Times newspaper to do it yesterday as they did, as the front page of their Times 2 section. A and 1, it's not on the front page of the paper. B and 2, it's the Times, which doesn't have a massive readership. C and 4, just checking. C and 3, it is the Times. Totally different when the front page of the Sun this morning lifts the idea and indeed has a picture accompanying it. Red Ed, Anton Decht. What does that mean? Well, two of the biggest stars on British TV have said they cannot imagine seeing Ed Miliband as PM, Prime Minister. They both, in this interview in the Times yesterday, they say that they've been loyal supporters and they point to the fact of their family backgrounds. Although one of them has flirted with the Conservative vote now and again. Oddly now, he says, they don't know what the party stands for and they couldn't vote Labour. That's bad enough. Front page of The Sun, the biggest selling newspaper in the land. You then go inside the Daily Mirror, which is very much a Labour-supporting paper, and they've got to do it, haven't they? Ant and Dec, two of the biggest stars in the TV stars in the country. We want to vote for Labour, but we can't picture Ed as the PM. This in the Daily Mirror. The lifeblood of the Labour Party. So isn't that the reality of it? Good bloke as he might be, well-educated, I'm sure, nice to his mother, nice to children and animals, but he just doesn't cut it as a PM. And when you think of some of the funds that Labour have had down the years, whatever you might think about some of the names I'm going to hurl at you, don't shout at me, but people like Wilson, people like Blair, my goodness me, they had charisma. Miliband? Really? Really? Ian Dunt is editor of politics.co.uk. This speaks to the problem Labour's got, doesn't it, Ian? Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the problems. And, you know, the way that Tories would often talk about this period of the election campaign, when they were trying to explain why they still felt a bit of confidence, even though the polls don't look like they're going their way, is they would always say Ed Miliband fails the blink test. They would always say, you know, there's just going to be this point where voters think, can I see him in number 10? Their answer will be no. And that's why the Tories will get in. I mean, whether they're going to make that judgment based on what Ant and Dec think, I think it's probably another matter.
They haven't got much time left. Do you think they can make Ed more voter-friendly? And if so, how?
No, I'm not sure they can. But he does have a fundamental problem with the way that he appears on camera. I have to say, I mean, you've probably met him. I mean, when you see him in person, I think he's a much more charismatic figure, actually. He's quite... He has a sort of gravity to him where you do see why he can command a certain degree of loyalty around him, and you do see why he's quite a compelling figure. It doesn't come out on camera. I mean, it doesn't come out in photographs, and it doesn't come out on TV either. He always looks very odd, very uncomfortable, kind of nervy. I don't actually think that would necessarily make him a bad prime minister. What it does is it makes him a very bad opposition leader, especially in the media age.
Take away his awkwardness. What sort of and if we did not live in the multimedia age of stations like LBC and Sky News and politics.co.uk, if we went back to the old days, good or otherwise, how would he actually be faring, do you think?
Yeah, I think he would still have some problems. And I think mostly that's around lack of consistency. So he's had, I mean, you know, if you put it down on paper, he's really quite brave, very interesting opposition leader. He takes on Murdoch, he takes on the Daily Mail, he takes on sort of private interests, massive corporations. These are all targets that are very popular with the public, people to try and take them on, and most political leaders don't have the bravery to do it. The thing is, there's no real consistency. So once he does those battles, he sort of banks the news story, but he doesn't push the message home every single day. Now, you look at someone like George Osborne, you just look at George Osborne's face, and the first thing that comes to mind is Labour didn't fix the roof when the sun was shining, because he had that message and he hammered it away and he hammered it away over the course of years until it was right there, right in front of your eyeballs. Ed Miliband hasn't really done that. He's had lots of very successful messages, but he hasn't really hammered any of them home.
Great speaking with you, as always, Ian Dunt, your editor of politics.co.uk. Listening, James Bloodworth is editor as well. He edits the Left Foot Forward blog. How much of a liability is Ed Miliband? Good morning.
Good morning. I think it's. I think we've been in denial on the left and in the Labour Party ever since he was elected in 2010, in a way. We've had this idea that ultimately it doesn't really matter what someone's personality is, like how charismatic they are or not. What really matters when it gets down to it is policy, but as has been is being demonstrated in every poll that comes out on Ed Miliband's personal ratings, people do care about the personality traits of the person who's going to be possibly prime minister, and I think that's completely normal. You want someone who demonstrates the qualities of leadership, someone who's going to be on the world stage dealing with someone like Vladimir Putin, for example. And I think that we have kind of, on the left at least, downplayed the importance of those personal qualities. But that said, he still is on course just about to win the election, I think.
And yet, and of course, we can trade statistics and polling figures with each other as much as you like, but it is interesting that whereas a high proportion of Conservative voters can see David Cameron as Prime Minister, there's quite a high percentage of Labour voters who can't actually imagine seeing Ed Miliband as Prime Minister.
Yes, definitely, and this is the big thing that, one of the big reasons why the election's so uncertain is that there's this fear on the left and among Labour supporters that on polling day people are going to get into the polling booth and think at the last minute, even though they may sympathise with some of the policy proposals, can I really see this man in number 10 Downing Street? And there's a fear that people will think, well, no, I can't. Let's stick with what we know. Let's kind of cast a vote for David Cameron.
Do Ant and Dec matter? I mean, obviously for ITV they matter, and of course they matter to their respective families, but do they actually matter in terms of this? Is it just more embarrassing mood music for Labour?
I don't think people take them particularly seriously. I mean, they seem to be ubiquitous on Saturday night television. I don't know how personally popular they are, though. More interesting is how this has been interpreted, because in this interview, they also were very strong in their criticism of the coalition.
Yes.
They just didn't want to see another coalition, and that hasn't really been reported. Because, again, it doesn't really tie into this ongoing story about Miliband's leadership. I thought the Mylene Klass incident was much more damaging, because there was this kind of... She really took him on the policy, and I think that really cut through, and I didn't think he responded particularly impressively, although I do think he's right. I think
that was about... Like that much just damaging. Remind my listeners, James, that's when you said... She said, you can't tax everything, you want to tax this glass of water, or something like that. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, and it really... cut through to this impression that Labour's just going to come in and you know, back to high spending, high tax, the problem Labour's had for, you know, decades.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed. James Bloodworth edits the Left Foot Forward blog. Why don't you check it out? And indeed, if you are of the left, you're going to come into play now. I'd love you to ring me and say that you are pretty much a stalwart Labour voter all your life. Possibly your dad and your mum, possibly your grandparents working. You don't have to be working class, actually, but it might be to the narrative that you've always voted Labour and you're happy to vote Labour again. You're sick and tired of these personal attacks on Ed Miliband. Clearly, you could argue, the other teams are just playing the man, they're not playing the ball. Or are you like Ant and Dec? And this is what makes it relevant, with respect to my contributor there. These two lads are from pretty, well, they say, from working class families in Newcastle, who voted Labour. They voted Labour. They can't bring themselves to do it because I'm not sure I could picture him, Miliband, as Prime Minister, says one of them. Dec, are they onto something? Let's start with Liam in Hainault. Liam, what are you going to tell me? Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Nick. I just want to say, I'm 18, and okay. So this is the first time I'm going to be voting at next general election. I have to say, I did read this story last night, and I'm a bit disappointed, because it shows that there was a key word that I read in what Beck was saying, and that was picture. And it shows he's still focusing too much on image. Unfortunately, the very, very heavy coverage of Ed Miliband's all right publicity gaffes, the fact he may not be able to eat a bacon sandwich properly, he's had to debate against Mylene Klass over his mansion tax. It shows that we're still focusing too much on what Ed Miliband right, looks like, as opposed to this determined, strong, not taking any prisoners, David Cameron image that that people do see. In actual fact, I support what Ed Miliband's doing, and I'm actively supporting him and voting for him because of policy and the policies that he's going to be implementing, I think, are in the best interest of this country, and especially for young people like me looking to get up the ladder and try and actually make a go of life.
You're right, but I'm sure, and you sound a very bright young man. Actually, let's do this chronologically. Are you excited that you're able to vote, or are you just doing it because your mum and dad are shouting at you, you need to vote?
No. I actually do believe that that voting does make a difference.
Okay.
You're obviously
a bright fella, and you track politics to a degree, and you may well be right in what you say, and perhaps it is a little unfair. And you talk about image, but is it not the case now that image is so important, Liam?
Yes, of course, image is important, but it should not be the overriding factor. And I do fear a lot of Labour voters, like Ant and Dec, say that they do want to vote Labour, but unfortunately, because of the leader, they can't.
Now, I think that's more to do with image than it is about policy. Mm. Of course, image is definitely important, and I will openly say I don't think Ed Miliband is as refined as David Cameron when it comes to PR relations and the rest of that stuff. But image should not be the overriding factor that motivates people's decisions in this general election, because it's so important that the policy is right.
Just respond lastly, if you would, to this, Liam, this email that's just been handed to me. Johnny writes as follows. Well done, Anton Deck, for saying what we think about Ed Miliband. He looks weird, sounds weird, and he is weird. Can anyone seriously imagine this odd grommet lookalike standing next to Obama or Merkel and representing our country?
I've heard that said at my school, and I think it just sums up what I've said. It's unfortunately people now have the wrong perception of what Ed Miliband is about, and because of that, it is sort of like blinkered them to what he was actually doing, which is standing up to tax avoiders, standing up to the privatised.
Yeah.
Systems such as the energy companies.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
The proportion of men taking their own lives in the UK has reached...
2013, journalist Peter Grester found himself at the heart of the story, something that journalists try and avoid, as he was tried on charges that included spreading false news and aiding the Muslim Brotherhood. After more than a year behind bars, he was freed and deported, landed safely at Cyprus on his way back to his native Australia. He's in London at the moment. Indeed, he was honoured at the RTS, the Royal Television Society Awards, last night with a special award. He joins me on the end of the line now. Peter, good morning to you. If we go back to the time of your arrest, what do you remember specifically about that day? Good morning.
It started out pretty much as a normal day. We'd finished up the day. I was in the hotel room in the Marriott and getting ready to go out to enjoy an evening, a dinner with an old colleague of mine, an old friend and colleague, when the door burst open and a very large bunch of officers burst in and started going through the room. They hauled me off and I joined my colleague, and we found ourselves in a police cell that night, a very crowded police cell, and really not quite sure what on earth was going on. No one ever really told us what we were being arrested for. We had no idea that it would be quite so serious. We thought it'd be over fairly swiftly.
When was it finally made plain to you why they sensed they wanted to arrest you?
When they laid charges, which took about a month into the process, a month after we'd been arrested. We got a sense of what was going on during the interrogation process, but it was really only when the charges were formally laid that we discovered that we had been accused of actually collaborating with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Just remind the listeners the context of that, Peter, why the Muslim Brotherhood was so such a key issue at that time.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood was an organisation that had been elected to government in the previous elections. They'd been deposed. In an uprising, the new government, the new administration, was very closely connected to the military, and they saw the Muslim Brotherhood as an existential threat. They accused the Brotherhood of being involved with terrorism, and so our alleged association with the Brotherhood meant that we had also been accused of collaborating with terrorists.
It's important to name your two colleagues from Al Jazeera, Mohamed Fahmeh and Baher Mohamed. Now, their plight, if I can use that word, continues, Peter.
Well, their plight and indeed mine. We are still on under retrial. I've been released, and I thought that I'd be free of the process, but we discovered when the retrial began about a week ago, that I was still on the books as a named defendant. But those guys are now out on bail. Now, that's very good news. We're very encouraged by that. We think that it's a good sign from the court. But at the same time, this is a judicial process. Legally, nothing much has changed. We are very concerned about the process. We know that we're innocent, and the Court of Cassation, the appeals court, which ordered the retrial in its judgment, said that there was no evidence, that the prosecution had failed to prove its case. And so we are as confident as we can be that this retrial process will vindicate us. But, of course, that's up to the court to decide. I'm obviously very concerned about it, but within the context of this, we think that there's a very good chance that we will see the end of this.
Any idea when?
No, how long's a piece of string?
Yeah, sure.
You know, it could be dismissed fairly swiftly, but I have a feeling that, well, our original trial took 5 months to go through.
Lord. More than 12 months behind bars. What sustained you, Peter?
Yeah, 400 days. It was pretty difficult, and we had no idea really when the whole thing was going to come to an end. In fact, on the day that they released me, I was really mentally preparing for at least another 6 months, if not another 6 years in prison. I realised that you've got to stay fit. In prison we saw quite a number of people who were broken by the process, and I felt determined not to go that way. And I realised that although you lose control over almost every aspect of your life, there are a few tiny things that the prison authorities can't take away, and that's control over your immediate physical body. We weren't physically harmed or threatened in any way. So we made an effort to keep fit, physically fit. We had a corridor, and I'd run up and down that for almost an hour each day, running at least 8 or 10 kilometres, if not more. I also was able to convince the prison authorities to let through some study materials, and so I took on a master's degree in international relations. And I also spent quite a bit of time trying to meditate, just to try and keep my head in a stable place. So consciously trying to keep physically, intellectually, and spiritually fit.
How has prison altered you?
This might sound a little bit weird, to be honest with you, but I think in a strange way it's been good for me. In that, I think most people are far more capable of dealing with difficult situations than they ever appreciate.
But mate, let me tell you, if I found myself in an Egyptian jail, I'm in pieces, I would have thought. Within hours.
Well, perhaps, you know, but the thing is that you and most people have never been in that situation, so it's difficult to say, and I'd venture to suggest that you could probably cope with it far better than you imagine. You might think you'd be in pieces, but you deal with what you have to deal with at that moment. I've been lucky enough to be tested and realise that actually I can put up with it. Before we went in, if you'd have asked me the same question, I'd have given you the same answer that you just gave me.
Yeah.
I've figured out that actually I am stronger than that, and that's quite huge. That's a big step forward.
Hey, good luck to you, buddy, and to your mates, and congratulations on that award. I was in the room when it happened, and very deserving a Royal Television Society award there to Peter Grester, the journalist, Al Jazeera journalist. 400 days in an Egyptian jail. Peter Grester, thank you. President Putin, in the eyes of Michael Fallon, the defence secretary here in Britain, poses a real and present danger to the Baltic states. NATO is getting ready to respond to any aggression, so says the defence secretary. He goes on to say the Russian leader is as much of a threat to Europe as IS, the Islamic State. Is he right? Sergei Karagnov is political analyst, head of the Moscow-based think tank Council for Defence and Foreign Policy, and is a former advisor to Vladimir Putin. Concerns over here in Britain, how valid are they, Mr. Karagnov?
Of course, it's complete fiction. It's really sad that, high-level officials, concoct such fiction or absurd accusations. Normally, they're done by journalists, some journalists who are paid for that. We are reaching, ever lower levels of civilized behavior, but with this behavior, we could end up with a big war in Europe.
You talk about that, but one has to say, how civilized was it to move in on another sovereign state, the Russians' actions in the Ukraine?
Russia has said many times that if and when it comes to a possibility of Ukraine getting into the Western Alliance or NATO, and it gets again another closer, there will be a war. The war started in Ukraine, and it is an inter-Ukrainian war, where Russia clearly sympathizes with one of the sides of the conflict.
But sympathizes is one
that
thing.
That is the result, yes, that is the result of the 20 years Western policy encroaching on Russian security interests.
Right.
By expansion of NATO. Ukraine was unpalatable.
But there seems to be fairly united global condemnation of the actions taken by Putin and Russia, though.
I'm terribly sorry, but the global condemnation takes about 20% of the world population. Most of the non-Western countries side with Russia.
How do you know that?
On that, or I mean, in even in the famous UN vote, all the Western countries voted, and some were their close clients. Well, biggest countries like Brazil, China, and others, and many others, most others, actually abstain. And then we know that they support us.
Just lastly, on the idea of Russian aggression, and I hear you don't hold with that, but why is it necessary for Russian bombers to fly off the British coast recently? I appreciate it's not your decision, but
of course,
how is Britain going to view that, aggressive?
Unfortunately, we are living in the world of lies. Of course, we are accusing, British coasts, but what you do not know is that, during the last several years, and even in the days of, in the previous two decades when allegedly the Cold War was closed, the Western bombers were crossing Russian coasts. And during several years, there was a several-fold increase in cruising of Russian coasts by Western military planes.
Right.
So we are doing the same, unfortunately.
This is how wars break out.
Yes, that's why I'm very much concerned, because we are, we act like children, and we have been acting like children. We lost the peace which was in the offing after the end of the Cold War, and we could end up in a very bad confrontation. We're already in a really bad stage.
Fascinating speaking with you, and I'm grateful for your time. I sense if you're up for it, we'll talk again. Sergei Karaganov, thank you. You're a political analyst. You're head of the Moscow-based think tank Council for Foreign and Defence Policy, and crucially in this, you're a former advisor to Vladimir Putin.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, Ken Livingstone and David Mellor, Saturday mornings from 10.
The increasing number of American politicians saying that Putin is a real threat to Western Europe.
I mean, the thing about Putin is he a serious loony tune who would actually go to war, or is he someone who's actually basically a decent fellow, kind to animals, helps old ladies across roads, and would just back off when it all gets tricky?
Ken Livingstone and David Mellor, Saturday mornings from 10, only on LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
A parent who, understandably, does not want to be named, says she received a call from a member of staff at her school suggesting her son, who has autism, took an authorised absence. We'll play you that message in just a second. It would appear the school, Matravers School in Wiltshire, had an offset inspection on the way, and they didn't want the child coming round. Obviously, we're not naming the child. We are not naming the mum at all. But listen carefully. We've tried to tidy it up a bit, but it is difficult. This was obviously taped on an answering service. You'll hear the school say, and I'll quote it so you can work it through, quite concerned how he, so he needs a boy, will deal with strange people coming up to him in his lessons, possibly coming up to him and talking to him about his work. And then the fact that if something kicks off in the school day tomorrow, we may not have enough staff to deal with them. Here's the message.
And I'm just quite concerned as to how going to deal with strange people coming into his lessons, possibly coming up and talk to him about his work. And also by the very nature of the fact that something may kick off in the school day tomorrow, and we may not have more of the staff to deal with him.
So, your son's got autism, keep him at home, because it's all a bit too tough, really. No wonder the mum's pretty angry. I'll tell you what the school says in a moment. Reverend Elaine Loydal has two children with Asperger's, which is part of the autism spectrum, joins me now. May I call you Elaine, or would you rather have Reverend?
Of course you may.
Elaine, thank you. To listeners who are not familiar, are not aware what it's like, if I can use the word coping, you might find that offensive, and apologies if you do, but coping with children with this condition, what is life like?
It's pretty tough, but it's actually made worse by other people's issues with your child and their discriminatory comments, their lack of awareness, and a lack of tolerance, quite frankly. It just compounds all the issues that you're already dealing with and trying to support your child through.
When you say people, do you mean institutions such as the NHS and education and others, or do you mean people in shops and coffee shops and theatres? What is it you're talking about?
I'm actually talking about on many occasions, professionals that ought to know better and actually oughtn't to be allowed to get away with discriminating and intimidating people in the way that they do.
You sound a very confident woman. I bet people might have tried it with you, but they've not got very far. What sort of things have happened to you?
I've had situations in school where a learning support worker, this was a mainstream school, actually said to another child, "Oh, give him the chair back before he has a spazzy." Sorry, totally inappropriate.
And again, apologies for anyone who was offended by that word, but it is very pertinent to our conversation. So when one of my colleagues phoned you and told you about the incident involving this school, how did you react? Were you surprised? Were you horrified? Did you think, actually, that isn't so surprising for me?
Because of our own awful experience and those I've seen experienced by other families that I've advocated for, I'm not at all surprised, even though I continue to be absolutely appalled. Things aren't changing. My kids are now 22 years old, and nothing's changing. I'm talking to parents now who are experiencing the same sorts of things that we were experiencing all those years ago.
What would you say to the school?
I would say, get a life. Get some integrity and recognise that every child matters and should be celebrated for its uniqueness.
The school has said that there's a requirement to inform parents of upcoming inspections, and they talk about some of our most vulnerable students who might have struggled with unfamiliar adults appearing in their lessons or meeting with them around the school site. So they're saying, although it could have been handled better, they did it for all the right reasons. Is that true, that possibly a vulnerable student could have struggled with meeting an unfamiliar adult on campus?
Children, particularly with autism and autism-related conditions, obviously do find a change in routine and a change meeting new people and that sort of thing quite difficult. But actually, it's part of their life and learning experience. And it's important for them to be prepared for those experiences and to be gradually exposed to them so that they can learn how to deal with deviation from routine or disappointment when things change as they grow, because that's what's expected of all people in adult life, whether we like it or not.
I would urge anybody with issues perhaps to get in touch with you. You seem very, very strong on this and also very knowledgeable. Do you have a website or something like that that people can find you?
No, I don't. I'm just me.
You're just you.
I've tried to support
those
other parents who have come into contact with me. Obviously, it's time. It's time in dealing with your own children. It's time with trying to keep a roof over your head and clothes on your back and food in your belly.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your time today. Reverend Elaine Loydal has two children, albeit older children now, who have Asperger's. That's the parental side. Let's get the education side from John Bangs. Regularly helps us with education stories. Former head of education at the NUT, visiting professor at the Institute of Education. Can you agree with me, John? The school got this hideously wrong.
Well, it looks as if that's the case, but whether they felt forced into that situation is a comment on the inspection framework and the fear, I have to say, that head teachers and indeed teachers and the school corporately has about Ofsted inspections. And also, I have to say, the fact that if they are worried about that, their anxiety that the inspectors actually won't be able to cope themselves or will give critical comments about what's going on in the school if they see a child with autism. It does actually raise a massive question about the competence of school inspections and also the outcomes, which obviously the school itself is extremely anxious about. And we have consistently, when I was in the NUT and since being at Cambridge and at the Institute of Education, tracked the fact that the inspection system in this country is more likely to trigger fear rather than positive improvements.
What should the school have done in this instance?
Well, I'd say I don't particularly want to comment on the case because I don't know the full facts, but what a school should have done was, in that situation, if it felt it had to inform parents, is simply say, the inspection is taking place, these are the circumstances, we'll do our best for your child. Your child may return home anxious or concerned, but we will certainly do our best for the child, and inspections are a matter of routine.
John, thanks. John Bangs, your former head of education at the NUT, National Union of Teachers, visiting professor at the Institute of Education. Coming up, coping with life. If you have a child, no matter what age, and you're currently coping, don't get offended, but it is a word I'm using. I know many of you get upset with that word. Or working with a child, albeit maybe now an adult with Asperger's or autism, do give me a call. The school apology in full. We apologise for any misunderstanding. There is a requirement to inform parents of upcoming inspections. It is common practice to change timetables during inspections. For some of our most vulnerable students who may have struggled with unfamiliar adults appearing in their lessons or meeting them around the school site, we contacted these parents and asked for their help and support in preparing their children for this change to the environment. That's probably what that deserves, I would suggest. Ruth's in Cambridge. Hello, Ruth.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm a bit puzzled by this school, to be candid with you. I don't know why they took this action. It seems pretty heartless, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it is. I've struggled with my son all through his childhood, really, with school, with professionals, everything. I mean, Sam didn't have any speech until he was five.
Oh, boy. Wow.
And I worked very, very hard with him. And I even had... Sam used to make what other people would consider inappropriate sounds in the back garden. I even had a letter from one
of
the
neighbours. What do you mean, sort of shouting?
Because he couldn't speak, he would be sort of, you know, that
sort of
thing.
Yeah, I've heard that, yeah.
I even had a letter from one of the neighbours, a gentle warning, please could you keep your child quiet?
Bizarre,
doesn't it?
What was your reaction? I don't want to think what your reaction was to that.
I didn't know who it was. If I had known, I think, well, I would have gone round and talked to them.
Yeah, I bet.
But also, it's a complete and utter lack of understanding of youngsters on the autistic spectrum. And the thing is, it's a very, very common disability now, as we all know. We see it a lot on television. It is around us, but there still seems to be this ignorance. I had quite a lot of behavioural problems with Sam when he was young. And I took him to see a paediatrician, and he basically said, well, there's not anything I can do, and he'll never go to mainstream school. But Sam went to mainstream school. He coped really, really well. He is quite laid back, whereas, obviously, with autism, there's varying degrees of it. But Sam is quite laid back. But even through school, there was still a lack of understanding. He was expected to conform with all the other children, which obviously with autism is very, very difficult. But it just, and I was a teaching assistant as well, and I saw it time and time again.
Right.
You know, with children on the autistic spectrum, where the understanding just wasn't there.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.
Britain's Conversation. Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
The proportion of men taking their own lives in the UK has reached its highest level for more than a decade. I've certainly lost a friend to suicide, and I know the impact that can have on families and anyone who knows the individual, really. It's such a shock and a jolt.
Sheila Fogarty. Weekday afternoons from 1. Only on LBC. Weekend mornings from 10 on LBC. Tomorrow morning, Beverly Turner.
There's been a sort of reduction, hasn't there, in the dignity and the respect that we afford old people. You know, you used to be able to turn to an old-timer, didn't you, to explain the world. Now we get on Google. If we have trouble working the computer, we ask a teenager. If we're not respecting our old people enough, how are we going to give them the right sort of care that they need?
Beverly Turner, Sunday morning from 10 on LBC.
Good morning to you, this is Andrew Pearce, it's the LBC, it's the Saturday morning breakfast show coming up. The Greeks, they blinked at the last minute, they'll be staying in the Euro after all, but for how long, I wonder. Talking about three teenage girls, they've walked away from their loving family, they're on their way to Turkey, on their way to Syria. What drives three clever girls out of the army?